Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Mouse. This is where we affirm and celebrate the power of dreams, coincidence, imagination in our lives. Do you know the jinn? Singular genie. You've heard of the genie. And maybe you've seen the genie in the Disney World. The genie of the lamp. Maybe you saw the handsome philosophic genie played by Idris Elba in the movie 3,000 Years of Longing. Maybe you've read a rather wonderful novel, which is out by Helena Wecker, called The Genie and the, and it's called The Golem and the Genie, where a genie says this about his kind. He says, they can change form to whatever suits their mind and appear to men's eyes in that form as the whirlwind appears in the dust that it carries. We have a wonderful guest today. Her name is Lana Nasser. She is a filmmaker. She is a performing artist. She's a voice artist. She is many, many things. And among all those many things, she tells us that she's been dreaming with the jinn and been having something of a love affair with the jinn since her childhood. And the jinn became the subject of her master's thesis in consciousness. Dream worker, workshop facilitator, Lana bridges worlds through her dream work, through her nature wisdom, through her performance, making spaces where imagination becomes a lived shared experience. And it's in the space of imagination that we will find, if we do, these imaginal creatures. The jinn. Welcome, Lana.
Thank you, Robert. I'm glad to be here.
So you begin in childhood. You say your love of the jinn began when you were a child and lasted ever since. Tell us about some of those early experiences and how that evolved.
Sure. So I'll just say as a beginning is that in our mind, when I was younger, I didn't see the connection between the jinn and the genie and the magic lamp. So it's almost that came later somehow. But with the jinn, I remember I wasn't yet 10 years old, and sitting next to my aunt, I think we were in Jericho, so sitting around the fire, and she was saying, don't throw water out at night without saying Bismillah in the name of God. Otherwise, you might, splash a jinn with the water, and it would get upset, and it would either come after you or possess you. And so, of course, the first thing I did when I went back home was find a moment where no one was watching and take a bucket of water at night and start throwing gin around everywhere. And no gin came up that day. But that night, I dreamt of a flame, like a fire flame, running after me. And that didn't make me afraid. It made me more curious. I was always really searching for contact, and then just having unusual experiences, let's say, with the imaginal realm, with feeling of a presence, a loving presence, actually. It was never scary, so I was never really one to be afraid of the jinn. And, so that's one of the first experiences.
Mm. So that's where it begins. You know, religious scholars these days talk about intermediary beings, which for some reason they like to call them in German Zwischenwesen, the in-between beings. And of course the jinn fit into this category, this vast category of beings who are between the realm of time and the realm of the eternal, between humans and God or the gods. And so in some senses they have, you know, they can be compared to other orders of beings in that imaginal realm, but they're not angels or demons or devils, are they? They're a separate kind. So talk to us a little bit about what makes the jinn different. And as you're thinking about that, I'm looking at a quotation from a medieval Muslim jurist, Ibn Hazm, who's issuing a ferocious warning to those who refuse to believe in jinn. He's telling them, you can't be a Muslim if you don't believe in jinn. He issued this edict back in 1064 of the Common Era. The one who denies the existence of jinn or comes up with interpretations denying them a place in the external world is a disbelieving polytheist whose blood and wealth can be lawfully claimed. Wow, that's pretty strong endorsement for the reality of jinn, you know, from one of the Orthodox ulema, one of the Sharia judges. So you've got to believe in jinn or else you're not a Muslim. I think most of us, whatever our religion or lack thereof, are prone to believe in in-between beings. I mean, we see them different ways. We have different names for them. They're not necessarily the same. But tell us, for you is distinctive about the jinn?
Yeah, well, first I'm just going to say to that is because they're mentioned in the Quran. So because they're mentioned in the Quran, then denying them is denying something as a fact that's mentioned in the
yes.
Quran. I wouldn't phrase it as he does in this, you know, the punishment and
threat,
all that.
You can't yeah. deny the jinn.
No, but the question is, what are the jinn to deny them or not deny them? And I think this is where the difference comes. You know, we have a tendency to literally interpret things. And yes, some people see the jinn as separate entities, or they see them in this kind of, you know, they are not gods. And they, let's begin with actually their mention in the Quran, because that's a basis. So in Arabic we have ins, which is humans, and jinn, which is the jinn. But it, in the language, ins is from visible, seen, sensed, company, and that is human. And jinn comes from jinn, jannah, to be invisible, unseen, hidden. So when we pair it, which the Quran does, with ins and jinn together, is what we have is the seen and the felt and the unseen, and the invisible. So whether we see that as entities that exist as actual beings or as aspects of ourselves and reality. And the more we learn about whether it's quantum physics or the nature of reality, is that there is always the hidden and the seen. So in its very simple form, is the jinn are the hidden, the unseen, on the other side of the veil. And they exist in a realm parallel to our own, existent all the time. So, and they have a foot here and a foot there because they're invisible, they're imaginal, but they can, and for some people they do see them as manifesting physically, whether in the form of an animal or even a person. But they're, to me, they're more mystical, psychological, spiritual dimensions of human beings. They're not even separate from us as entities. They just have a different makeup. So we're made from
right. And they're particularly active. They're particularly active in our dreams. I mean, they give form to things that happen in dreams, correct? You wrote a beautiful essay about the jinn as they appear in dreams. Talk to us about that. Talk to us about the relationship between the jinn and our dreaming.
Well, we have the imaginal realm, so that's the large realm in which the dream and the jinn inhabit. And it's, as you well know more than anyone else, with the dream world, with us being open to these other dimensions of reality. And the jinn make their way there, so whether they come appearing as jinn or as animals or even providing inspiration, or as companions, or some people even think that actually when we sleep, it's our double, our jinn double, that does the travel and that does the adventures and the experiences. So they're akin to the dream realm because they're shapeshifters. They transcend time and space. They they are symbolic in their very nature. So not only do they speak symbolically, but they themselves are symbolic. They are fire, so they have no form. They cling to a shape, and so they achieve it. They actually take on the form that they consume or embrace, let's say. And so they're at home in the dream world, and I think that's one of the most accessible places for us to encounter them. It's not in waking life.
Right. I mean, there's constant ambiguity, isn't there? This is constant porosity of borders. I mean, boundaries won't stay fixed. Visible, invisible, imaginal, real, back and forth. I was looking again at what the wonderful English cultural historian Marina Warner wrote about the jinn. She wrote, "The jinn introduce a dynamic of pure chance, which runs alongside the larger designs of fate, now meeting them, now parting from them, rather as the breeze on the sea will form cross currents in the wave pattern on the surface, which sailors watch carefully to determine the direction of the wind they can catch, rather than the current or the tide in the water." I grew up seeing beings that are somewhat like some descriptions of the jinn, but we didn't call them jinn. We called them, for example, from the Irish, the she. And more recently, when I was sleeping in Sligo under the shadow of Ben Bulben, the mountain where Yeats would see the fairies trooping out of a door in the wall of the mountain, I met someone, a wraith-like figure, very beautiful, very wind-like, very diaphanous, who looked a bit away, a bit like some descriptions of the jinn. But I don't know that the she and the jinn are one and the same. I mean, there are cultural differences amongst the tribes of the imaginal realm, just as there are amongst humans, aren't there? Mm. And the differences between different tribes of jinn. I mean, some are Muslim, some are not, and so on.
Yeah.
But and then we come to this whole question, which you introduced so elegantly. What is inner? What is outer? What is psychic? What is physical? What is imaginal? What is real? Is the jinn part of me? Is it my projection? Is it my double? Is it inside me? Is it outside me? And these questions really are very difficult to answer in the presence of such ambiguous shape-shifting forms. Tell us some more stories. You know, let's have some adventures. Tell us some adventures, your own and those that you attract, involving the jinn and dreaming in particular.
Yeah, I love the description that she gives of that, exactly. And they are ambiguous. Like, that is their nature, which we are very difficult to accept. They're in their nature ambiguous. But I do think that they have connections with fairies. I think a lot is connected to language. So there is certain, whether it's psychic experiences or spiritual beings, that is just like humans. You know, a Bedouin dresses differently than someone in Siberia. But they're still humans. So they have different aspects, different ways of doing things. But they belong to the same, I would say, class. So and especially fairies. With their fiery, trickstery, magical elements, I think they definitely have a lot in common with the jinn. So they would be able to communicate, because it's just the Arabic way of saying, describing this kind of entity. And of course, it's connected to the language. There's so many stories. I'm wondering I'm trying to think what are you curious about, Robert? When it comes to the research, I think since my thesis, I stopped reading about the jinn. One of my supervisors said, the jinn don't want to be studied. They want to be experienced or danced. And I took that to heart, which for better or worse. But they keep showing up in my writings and in all of my work. They always find a way in. And so it's a chronic condition.
Did you say, do I have this right, that Hilo Sheikh, I think, in Jordan, found that you had a djinn inside you which he didn't think should be there, and he tried to get it out, and he failed. Was that your story
yes.
about yourself or your story about someone
yes.
else? Well, tell us that story.
No, that was definitely me. yeah, that was me. I was a young teenager at the point, and, you know, I was exhibiting characteristics that were not usual, which one of the names of the djinn is, for example, Marid, which comes from Tamarud, which means rebellion. So I was a rebellious, tempered, fiery, who likes to be alone in the dark, loves to look at fire, all these things that are associated in our culture with possible djinn possession and, you know, behaviors that go against the norm or they don't conform. And it's probably normal at that point to be rebellious against my parents, especially my mother. And my mother is not someone who is too superstitious, very educated, and, you know, but I guess she felt desperate. So she took me to this healer, and it was amazing to me because he's not what you would expect. He was a very soft-spoken man who had been studying in the U.S. and working in the U.S., but he had the gift of basar, which is sight, so he could see. And when I went to see him, he told me about things that happened with me that no one knows. For example, if I'm in my room sleeping and sometimes the light next to my bed would go on and off. So he said, this happens with you, and that was correct. Or feeling a presence when I'm sleeping. Also, the snakes that were visiting my dreams, which at that point were making me afraid. And he said that there was a djinn in me. And then he read some verses on me. So I just lay down. He had his hand not touching me, just above my stomach, reading verses. It was very tender, very different than other experiences when I studied my own research with spirit possession and how that's dealt with. And I was supposed to be healed, and I was given certain surahs to read from the Quran for protection, which are very powerful, and I still read them now, not for fear of jinn, but for as a protection, and as putting away evil thoughts, actually, or things that don't align. And but yes, he failed because the jinn didn't go away. I mean, they kept. They went dormant for a little while because he said to me that the dreams in which the snake appears, that he said that the snake, which is one of the manifestations that are common for the djinn, the snake, often in the old times, they would have a snake, an enchanted snake, to protect a treasure, which gives us another hint about the djinn and their nature of protecting treasure, hiding treasure, but making it possible to find for the right person or if they ask the right question. So for many years, I stopped remembering my dreams. And when I started studying dreams again when I was in California at JFK, of course, the dreams of the snakes would come back very strongly. And to me, the snake dreams and the djinn experiences are very related to each other because there was a reconciling for me, a meeting with this thing that I was made to be afraid of, to realize that, in fact, it was my ally. It was a spirit partner, a friend whom I can dance with and who sometimes could take over in ways that are unusual for other people, and entering into a trance or also sometimes in moments of inspiration, where you're taken, and the djinn are associated with poetic inspiration also as entities. But a few years later, then I end up doing my master's about it and studying other people, other healers, possession, the different ways of possession. So I found, for example, connections with the czar, which is done in more in Africa, where they don't exorcise the djinn, but it's more like the Orisha tradition, where they appease, there's a dance, there's music, and the djinn takes over a person until they just go into a trance and they just collapse. So a different way of dealing with it. But the same entities, I think, just a different way. How do we treat them? Are we afraid of them? Do we demonize them? Do we try to exert them away? Or do we befriend them? Because I think the djinn, working with djinn or working with that kind of energy, is very important in dealing with our own shadow. And shedding light on it.
I was waiting for the shadow to be mentioned. I was also thinking, before we could get too Jungian about this, that we do need a sacred psychology. Of course, Jung was not averse to a sacred psychology, but we do need a sacred psychology that recognizes different aspects of the self, even to the extent of recognizing that the self may be a sort of boarding house, a guest house, think about Rumi for a moment, in which different entities and personalities might all share a home. You know, one of them might be your Karin or your resident Jinn, who, according to Ibn Arabi, has to be educated and raised by you and broken in. But certainly when you talked about turning those regarded as perhaps offensive or unwanted forces into allies and part of a whole household, I mean, that makes great sense. How very, very interesting. So where are you with all of this now? I mean, do you have interaction with the jinn? Do your dreams reflect this kind of reality?
Yeah, I feel like, again, it's a point that's with me at various times. So it doesn't feel like there's a separation. It feels, again, like the body that's always there. It's almost tuning in, tuning out, tuning in, tuning out. I give space for my jinn, so I have moments, which times where I think, okay, now is my time to let my jinn go crazy. In Arabic, junoon is madness from the same root. So to give that space of letting the jinn come out and express themselves, because like they say, fire if it's not allowed to burn, if it's held closed, then it becomes like arsid smoke that suffocates.
Right. So Lana Nasser. We're talking about dreams and we're talking about jinn, and we'll be back to talk about all sorts of good things after the break. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Noss.
Where can you find out about dreams and the dream world? MossDreams.com. At MossDreams.com, you can find out about Robert Moss, his work, and discover the way of the dreamer. Read numerous articles and essays on almost every facet of dreams. Find out Robert's class and workshop schedule. Read reviews and so much more. Visit MossDreams.com to find your way of the dreamer. That's MossDreams.com.
Robert Moss has a deep engagement with the dream world. And now you can take a crash course from this master of the act of dreaming at your own pace. That's right. You can get Robert's 8 exciting half-hour programs on a new DVD set called Way of the Dreamer. Share Robert's story as a dreamer and dream healer. This dynamic 3-DVD set can help teach you how to find your way through your dreams to realize your full potential. Don't wait to learn the practical dreamwork techniques that can help you understand how to attain better health, emotional stability, spiritual awareness, and more. Order Way of the Dreamer DVDs today from Amazon.com or MossDreams.com. That's MossDreams.com.
We're HealthyLife.net, reaching and helping a worldwide audience without hype, without shock, and without shenanigans.
You're listening to Way of the Dreamer. This is Robert Noss. Our wonderful guest is Lana Nasser. You can find her at her website, Lana, L-A-N-A, Nasser, N-A-S-S-E-R, one word, LanaNasser.com. She's a wonderful, wonderful dream worker, performing artist, voice artist, dancing between languages and across genres, and she's very generously talking about her own encounters over the years with a tribe, more than a tribe, actually, of intermediary beings that are known as jinn or hidden ones. Actually, there's a comparable name in Scandinavia for these in-between beings. Huldufolk, you've probably heard that line of the Huldufolk, the hidden folk, that's what they're called in Iceland. Those are the people that are between the worlds of time and eternity. And, of course, In dreams any night, whatever we think about this, whether we have a theory about it or not, we have an experience. I mean, in dreams we do travel into realms beyond the physical. Dream worlds might be real worlds. Certainly most human cultures have thought so. They've thought whether it's the imaginal realm, the Balzac, the isthmus between time and eternity, whether it's the really real world, an Aboriginal people of West Australia say. They say the dream world is really real. Don't get confused about ordinary reality being the real world. The dream world is really, really real. Most human cultures have thought that. Most human cultures have actually thought it was a good idea to recognize that some aspect of the self, call it soul, call it consciousness, can travel back and forth from the body into other places and might find treasures there. That's what Ibn Arabi used to say. You go into the treasury, you go into the treasury of the imaginal realm, and you bring back riches. And Suruwadi, to again stay medieval and somewhat Sufi, Suruwadi says you've got to recognize that what's going on in dreams is related to what part of the dream was operating. I mean, if you're operating from a lower part of the self, a lower part of the nafs, all you're going to get is lower stuff, and probably confused and not useful. But if you're traveling in a part of the soul, a part of the ruh, you might have an al-ruya. I know my pronunciation is terrible, Lana, but you'll be merciful. You might have a true dream. Lana, last night I was thinking about the true dream in Islam. I mean, the idea is lovely, and that you might want to ask for a true dream, because in a true dream you might see the real logic of things, you might see the real order of things. If you're a monotheist, you might think that you will pick up a little bit of God's will, even if it's shown to you, you know, in a very stepped-down way by an intermediary being. And I was looking at a prayer that attributed to Aisha, the third wife of the Prophet, for asking for a true dream. You ask God to give you a dream that is true rather than false, that is beneficial rather than harmful, and that is remembered rather than forgotten. And I looked at this. I loved its simplicity. I mean, people set intentions for dreams one way or another. Istikhara, I suppose, is an Arabic form of this, Arabic practice. People set up all sorts of intentions for dream incubation, and they try to mimic what they think went on in ancient temples. But actually, to ask in the name of a benign divine being, however you name that being, if we're going to go universalist about it, to ask for a dream that is true rather than false, that is beneficial rather than harmful, and that is remembered rather than forgotten, that seems to me to be a very wise way to approach these things. Now, I did that last night, and I got some really weird dreams, but they might be exactly what I needed.
Yes, I'm very curious to hear them.
I think I'm going to spill the beans. I need to work through these. And although, as you know, I'm incredibly, almost ridiculously open in general, I think I will save the content of the dreams except for the final one, which I feel a little bit embarrassed to share. Someone like a prince of the Emirates of the Gulf, an Arab prince, modern rather than ancient, an Arab prince, approached me requesting me to write an article on dreaming in Islam. And I've written a bit about this, but I'm not an expert. I'm not Muslim, and I'm from outside the region, etc. And although I have good friends who are Muslims and Arabs and Persians and so on, I was somewhat surprised that after I requested a true dream, I get someone who appears like almost impossibly beautiful, modern Arabian prince asking me to write an essay on dreaming in Islam. So that I will share.
Wonderful. Well, if you need a research assistant, I'm available.
Well, I would undoubtedly need one, because as you and I both know, there's only so much you can do through reading and scholarship. I do a great deal of that, and of course I do field work in my dreams as well. I've dreamed into these areas. I've dreamed of traditions and approaches relating to Suruwadi in particular for much of my adult life, for example. And I've followed the research leads that those dreams have given me. So I've been fascinated by the idea of the imaginal realm for a very, very long time. It was probably only when I read Henri Corbin that I adopted the phrase. But I've known what it's about, as you have, for a very long time.
Yeah,
and
the teachings
in most of mystical tradition about this are profound. I mean, I must say I do feel a very strong gravitation to the mystical side of Islam, to the Sufis, to those great medieval philosophers. I was looking again at Ibn Sina's day, Avicenna, he's called in the West, and what he wrote about the different aspects of consciousness, of the self, of the soul, and how they operate in and out of dreams. I mean, there are riches here which outside a narrow circle of academics are generally unappreciated in the West.
Hmm. Yeah, to me as well, the mystical aspect of Islam is what calls to me, and I've been really returning to that in a much stronger way in recent years. And it's interesting to look at then the jinn and the related aspects of the shaitan or the iblis, which is often translated not exactly completely correctly as Lucifer or the devil, with the potential of these powerful entities for their transformation, alchemical aspects. You know, with Islam, they talk about the most qareens, the jinn companion, are a non-believer. And then Muhammad, the Prophet, said that God aided him in his qareen becoming a Muslim. I was thinking about that the other day, and like, what does that mean? Is because the jinn attach to complexes, they attach to weak things, they bring light into things that might be fears. So in dreams, I think a lot of times with things like nightmares, fears, the incubus, the succubus, so even sleep paralysis experiences are also mentioned by people who have been possessed by jinn as experiences in sleep, which brings in then, like, how do you deal with these situations? And it's all the same. It's how do I look in the face? It's the jinn as well. They appear to you to scare you. If you get scared, you're taken in their control, taken possession of. But you, if you're not, they open the world for you. They open keys. They show you the treasures. There, to how to relate to them as teachers with a burn.
Fascinating. All right, we're talking to Lana Nasser. We're talking about the dreams, about dreams. We're talking about jinn. We're talking about the imaginal realm. We're talking about how to get deeper and wiser with dreaming, because dreaming, you know, has its two wings, doesn't it? It will take us to worlds beyond the physical, and it will enable us to bring from worlds beyond the physical gifts that can orient, guide, and empower our everyday life. So we'll be back to talk more about all of this on Way of the Dreamer. This is Robert Moss. We're going to take a short break, and we will be back to dream some more.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you are interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com. Get your personal dream symbols and discover the ones you dream about in Linda McKenzie's Symbols of You, a new book available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, and more.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
We are talking to Lana Nasser. She's a wonderful, wonderful dream worker. She comes from Jordan originally, I think. She lives in the southern Netherlands. She's calling us from Netherlands. Bless you, Lana, for doing that. Her website, you'll find her at lananassa.com, or just enter her name, Lana, L-A-N-A, Nassa, N-A-S-S-E-R, dream worker, writer, performing, voice artist, dancing between worlds. So let's think a little bit more about, you know, what is going on with dreaming, why we all want to do more of it, how we have many different cultural traditions to draw upon. Lana, I think that in Islam, I'm no expert, but I think that in Islam it's accepted that one of the things that goes on in dreams is that we have contact, often very benign and helpful contact, with the departed, including wise teachers, including sheikhs, in the case of Islam, prophets and saints and so on. And I just want to mention to you that one of the characters who turns up in my dreams, and he's evolved since he died, is my favorite professor from my university days back at the Australian National University. I mean, I'll name him. His name is Manning Clark. He's Australia's most famous historian. He was a wonderful, generous patron to me. He appointed me lecturer in ancient history at the age of 21, which is pretty much unheard of, even in Australia. He died in 1991, and I dreamed of him, and he started appearing again and again. He showed me what he was doing, practicing a kind of meta-history with interesting study facilities, meeting other interesting characters, one or two he introduced. And then at the end of last winter, the last winter of last year, he turned up unexpectedly. And he played really a profound teacher, because instead of giving me advice or a solution for something that was bothering you at the moment, he said to me, Define for us, because he had friends in the background, what is the theme of your life and your work at this point? That's what my dead professor said to me, you know, decades after his death. Define your purpose, the theme of your work and your life right now. And I answered him inside the dream, and I wrote it down when I surfaced from the dream to write it down. I'm often in a condition of lucid dreaming in that half-dream state, the hypnopompic state after a dream, but I have to stir from it to write something down. Then I can sometimes go back and dream it on, which is what I did. But I wrote it down. And I wrote down, I don't have the exact words in front of me, I'd have to look them up, but I wrote down something as a theme. I wrote down something like, there is a world within reach of us where wise teachers are available. It was longer than that, better than that. So saying two things, there is another world accessible in altered states of consciousness, safely altered, like dreams and half dreams and journeys and meditation. It's right there. The imaginal realm is right there. Within it, we can find the teachers, the teaching institutions, the schools of higher knowledge, the places of initiation and transformation that we need. It's right there. Let's remember that there are ways of getting to it. And that was that I defined as my theme, and I think actually it wasn't a bad description of what I try to do as a teacher and what I most enjoy doing simply as an experiencer, somebody who likes to get out and about in the many worlds. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I love it. It's beautiful. It makes me think of my prayers for having basar, to have sight, to be able to see through the veils, which in waking, but especially in dreams. Because like you said, that is the place still of meeting the teachers. It is the past, the departed teachers, which we might know or not know, with the ancestors. It's the only open door, Islamically, for prophecy. So it's always that desire. Of course, dreams are so exciting. There's so much fun. There's so much exploration. There is, but I think the intentions, it's like using artificial intelligence. You know, you can use it to write an email to your boss, but that's a waste of energy. So how do we use dreams? How do we open up to dreams in ways, and you said that, I wrote it down, true, beneficial, and remembered, whether it's opening the doors for others to also go through that, but there's something, I don't know, I'm thinking now about responsibility as well. Going in, bringing something back, leading people, taking them there. But why? Why? For what? I think that's important. You know, why?
Well, I think the why is so that all of us help each other to become a bit more than we are. I mean, Jung would use the word individuation, a pretty ugly word, but to grow into our moreness, to make close acquaintance with our own greater self. I mean, I tend to go all Neoplatonic at this point and think about Plotinus, who says that the presiding genius or daimon or angel, if you like, of our life is the self on the level above the one we are on. And by extension, true progress, true evolution for an individual would be to have closer, both a connection with that self on the higher level, and perhaps even to join with it and become one. This has something in common with what you were saying about dealing with the jinn or the spirits inside us. I mean, rising on the planes would be a Western esoteric way of talking about it. And I approach this not in a sense of, not in a sense of great piety or solemnity. I approach it as part of the great game, because, as you say, dreaming is such fun. I don't want to give up the play of images. I don't want to give up the play of the many forms. I don't want to go into a vastness of vacancy and emptiness. That is the goal of some in some spiritual traditions. But for someone of the West and someone with strong indigenous affiliations too, I love the play of images. I love the play of the many. You know, I sometimes think that if we want to get to the one, we have to entertain the many and be entertained by the many and be amongst them. And dreaming is a safe and delightful way of doing that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And dreaming with a jinn is great, because they can help us fly and take that magic carpet throughout safely again.
Mm-hmm. It's all so simple, isn't it? You just answered your question so much better. You said, what's it all about? It's about remembering we can fly. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
Remember you can fly. I mean, Plato and Phaedrus says the soul started out winged, but then it lost its wings. But when you start to, when your soul really comes alive, you feel a prickling and an itching on your shoulder blades as your wing feathers begin to grow back, and you're getting ready to fly again. It's about remembering we can fly. And yes, the jinn are very helpful in that respect, because they don't take,
they take
themselves lightly as a set of angels. The jinn probably
definitely. I mean, the tricks. Sure, yeah, the trickster aspect and the humor and the madness and the flight. I think every dream that has some flight in it has a bit of jinn in it.
Yes. Well, it's been said of angels that they can fly because they take themselves lightly, but I think that line was stolen from the jinn. I think the jinn take themselves even more lightly. With angels, there can sometimes be a certain degree of solemnity, because after all, it'd be absolutely carrying out the will of the one, the will of God. So jinn are not under the same, not under the rules in the same way, let us say. All right, we're
so
talking
like
to Lana Nasser, having a really good time here. We're going to take one more break, and then we'll have one more episode to talk about what is available in dreaming. And I really do now need to tell Lana about the most important spiritual conversation of my life, which took place in a dream that I was able to stay with after waking. And it does take us into some aspects of, let's say, medieval Sufi mysticism. So I hope you're up for that.
Excellent.
All right, you're listening to Where's the Dream with Robert Moss. We'll be back after the break.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you are interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Robert Mouse, you're listening to Way of the Dreamer. Our fabulous guest is Lana Nasser. What a pleasure to be with you, Lana. What a pleasure to be turning cartwheels and larger wheels with all this interesting stuff. I wanted to tell you a dream that contains still for me the most important conversation of a spiritual nature in my life. So I will say I'd been reading quite a lot about the imaginal realms, Suruwadi, Naradi, all this stuff. So I dream that I'm at a quite good restaurant, a bit generic, but like a Parsi airport restaurant, and I'm having lunch with a very pleasant couple who are princes from the East. Princes from the East. I mean, they're dressed in Western clothes. She's wearing a veil, but it's not really an Islamic veil, but she's veiled. It's a somewhat diaphanous veil. It's a bit more of a priestess veil than an Islamic veil. Anyway, I've had enough lunch and I'm leaving, and suddenly an old friend of mine, old deceased friend of mine, they turn up in my dreams a bit, puffs up and says, Robert, have you forgotten? You're supposed to record the conversation. Look in the envelope. And I wake up with my friend's urgent breath and breathy words. Are you supposed to record? And I'm lying there in bed at 3:30 in the morning, and I put myself back in the dream and I open the envelope. And there are three documents. One is a clipping from a newspaper headed, "The Prince and Princess of Fars, F-A-R-S, are traveling abroad," and I know that Fars is the name for the old Persian heartland. And the second one is the one I'll focus on. It's a list of 20 questions that I'm supposed to put to the Prince and Princess from the East. So I go back, I'm lying on the bed, I bilocate. I mean, this is an essential aspect of lucid dreaming, I would say, which the lucid dream advocates sometimes fail to talk about enough. I'm on the bed, I have a yellow legal pad in my hand and a pencil or pen, and I'm also back in the dream. I'm in both places at once, and it's not confusing. And I talk to them again, and I start asking the questions. And the first question is, what is the nature of exile? And the second question is, what are the conditions for return? And these are questions about the soul, where it comes from, how it returns. It's got the stamp of traditions you will recognize. It's got the absolute stamp of traditions I've been studying, but it's also fresh and original. And I'm able, in this half-dream state, to record 13 of the 20 questions and 8 of the 20 possible answers, at which point I'm exhausted. I've got it written down. My writing is legible enough for me to type it up later. I just stagger down to the lake. We're staying in a cabin on a lake in the North Country. And I lie on a floating dock as the sun comes up, and the visual effect is really extraordinary. With the sun coming up, it looks as if the waters below me are the sky, and the sky is the water. And so that episode took me into what I felt was the heart of a certain tradition. And by the way, the prince's name was Shams. I don't necessarily identify him with Shamsi Tabrizi of Rumi, but his name is Shams, and you know what it means. It's a pretty important name, but I wouldn't presume to equate it with the Shams of Rumi, but that is his name. And that conversation, I tried to fill in the rest of the questions and answers later on, and I was not 100% satisfied, but what I had was quite enough to set me on a life path of that time. This is what it's about. It's about remembering where you come from on the level of soul or spirit. It's about finding the way to make the return and perhaps helping others to do that. It might sound a little bit solemn, but it was still tremendous fun.
Mm. Oh, so beautiful. She said that the nature of exile and the way of return, and when it comes to the Sufi path, but to the soul's path, I think, to just the soul's path of returning to the light. And I think even the name of Shams, well, even if not related to Shams of Tabrizi with Rumi, but Shams is sun, the sun. So yes. The source of light.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. And Surah Wa'if, to whom I felt a special affinity, is the Sheikh al-Ishraq, the Sheikh of the light, of the rising light, the Sheikh of the illumination. So anyway, I mean, my experience, and I think yours is probably comparable in our different ways, I mean, my experience is that dreaming takes us to really real things, to really real places. And we can try it in other ways. I mean, there are ways of piety, ways of, you know, ways of prayer, ways of meditation, etc. But dreaming is, can be just so fresh and spontaneous. And so I teach people to dream consciously, of course, and I combine it with shamanic methods. And just we don't do hallucinogenics, but we use drumming and we use nature sounds and other music and so on. It helps shift consciousness and keep it on track and screen out distractions. But we can get there. We can travel. We can bring back gifts.
Absolutely. And dreams is the safest way, and it's so available, and it's our birthright in the sense of being right there at our tips. When I was younger, I would just I couldn't wait to sleep. I was very easy to get to bed as a child. Never one of these kids was like, no, I want to stay up. I was always ready to go to sleep, to dream, and to continue back into my dreams. And yeah, I think I'm very attracted to the possibility of meeting teachers. I know in my dreams I've met various teachers, but there's one woman who comes quite often in, and she feels like a sheikha to me. I don't have a name for her at all, but some of my first remembered dreams, and also when I was studying about the jinn, where she would come, and always in the language of jinn, and I don't know about you, Robert, but they never come, the teachers, with clear instructions. They always come with a riddle somehow to solve, or it's never do this and do that. It's more, you have this and you have that. And where is the what with the path? Oh, yeah.
Yes, the extent that I think I've had conversations with jinn, and I shared a couple of them with you, they're always at a tilt. Nothing exactly straightforward is going on. I mean, I remember the one who I drew as a somewhat foxy-looking humanoid, but something of a fox and something of a star. I showed you the drawing. He says, oh, I live on the other side of wind. And I'd heard a phrase, something like that, from somewhere in the traditions of the imaginal realm, but I live on the other side of wind. And his statements about things were very interesting, but none of them were straightforward, and they would all require you to tilt your mind. Yeah, tilt your mind. Actually, my mind now goes Aboriginal Australian for a moment. The Aboriginal Australians say that if a spirit person, as a clever man or clever woman, shaman type, is around, it puts a tilt to the day. The world wobbles a bit. Nothing is straightforward. Everything is at a bit of an angle, a slant. It wasn't that before. So that was the effect of these encounters and visitations, which multiplied with the ones I think of as I learned more about them, studied them, talked about them, etc. I haven't had many of these encounters, although I actually am crazy enough to think that I met a genie in embodied form in Chicago once, and he was perfectly polite and respectful, but I didn't really think he belonged in my workshop, so before we started having marked him, I asked him to leave. And he left with great gentleness, great respect. So it's interesting how, you know, the boundaries might slip even in terms of what is human, how the shape-shifting might go on. Well, my dear, we're just about out of time. It just whizzed by, which is what happens when you're having fun. We've been talking to
Ramanasa. Yes, we can talk on forever.
About the jinn and about dreams and about imaginal possibilities. We'll be back after the break, really, to say thank you and onward. Listen to The Way of the Dream with Robert Musk. All right.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you are interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Well, thank you for listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss, our wonderful guest, Lana Nassa. Look for her online, Lana, L-A-N-A, Nassa, N-A-S-S-E-R. We'll bring up her website. She is a wonderful writer. She's got a Substack, which has some great pieces from time to time. She teaches and leads all sorts of interesting performance. And thank you so much for sharing your dreaming and your lifelong dance with the Zen, Lana.
Thank you so much for inviting me here and for your relationship with the djinn and bringing them and their lovely trickstery energy also through your work and your teachings.
Thank you. Thank you. I feel there's laughter moving with and around and through both of us. All right, everybody, may your best dreams come true and may you remember them.